News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, with you every Saturday afternoon here on News Talk 580 KMJ and online at kmjnow.com. Yesterday was Veterans Day, and I hope you made sure to honor all the veterans in your life. If you forgot, you can make up for it today, and I'm sure you'll be motivated to do that after you hear the story we have for you today. You know, over the years, with all the hundreds of veterans that I've met, every one of them has a story that strikes me on some level. But I have noticed that over the years, there are a couple kinds of veterans that I just absolutely cannot imagine what it must have been like to be in their shoes. Prisoners of war would be one of those categories. And another one, the Nisei veterans of World War II, the young Japanese Americans whose families were being held hostage by their own government, yet here they are wearing a uniform, fighting for that very government that had their families held prisoner, many of them losing property, losing just about everything they had. And that's the case today as I welcome in 87-year-old Robert Yano of Kingsburg, California. Although, I guess growing up, they had a different name for you. How'd they start calling you Dobie?
Well, that's when we were young, you know, we started playing marbles. And I think most of us would know what Adobe marbles are. Well, it just happened to be that that's the only ones that I had, is those marbles. And then they started to call me Adobe. Well, in Japanese, I think my dad, they can't say apple, they can't say you know.
Uh-huh.
So Adobe, see, that's how it just started, Adobe. That's where it started, was the marble part of it, Adobe.
Uh-huh.
That's where I got my nickname, and it just traveled with me wherever I went.
You could never shake it.
Even overseas, I thought I'd lost it. But it came back because you meet somebody, and uh-huh. It pops up, and there it is again.
Well, I try not to call you Adobe too much.
No, that's okay.
You're okay with it.
That's okay with it. Yeah.
Did anybody call you that last week in Washington, D.C.?
No.
Okay.
No.
Well, I want to talk about that. Before we go back in time, as we always do, to the 1940s, 2011 has been a special year for you. Last week, you were in Washington, D.C., along with many, many other Nisei veterans and their families, to receive the Congressional Gold Medal. How incredible was that for you, and what did it mean to be up there and to receive one of the highest honors that our government can give out?
You know, that's something that, it's unbelievable. It's unbelievable. I just couldn't believe it, that we got it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe some people say we deserve it, but to receive it, that's something else. It's really something that I'll never forget, never forget.
Well, I want to ask you more about that a little bit later, and maybe while we're talking, people that are curious about that can look up more on the Congressional Gold Medal online. I have some links set up at our website, kmjnow.com. But let's go back in time now. You're a Japanese American in Kingsburg, and everybody knows that's a Swedish town. I've talked to Rafer and Jimmy Johnson when they were some of the few African Americans there in the 1950s. How big was the Japanese American population there in the 40s when you were growing up?
Boy, I don't know. I can't really put the number of fingers there, but it's the old saying, you can count them on your hands, you might say. There are not too many of them, but they were. They were around, and I can still recall places that were that did business in there, and a couple of grocery stores in Kingsburg that were Japanese. Mm-hmm. So I can't say how many, but I know there were a few.
And most of your friends were probably Swedish or Scandinavian young men from school, huh?
Yes, my neighbor was Swedish, the Westland family.
Mm-hmm.
And Mrs. Westland, just like a mother to us, because we stayed there and we slept over there and we did everything together. And those days, you know, everybody had a hard time, their mm-hmm. parents, our parents. And so we did what you call trading things with a can of milk,
mm-hmm.
a cup of sugar, a couple of eggs. These were the neighbors of Weston family right next to it. We just one big family.
I'm guessing you didn't feel like the people of Kingsburg treated you any differently than anybody else.
No, I don't think so. I didn't. No, I didn't think anything about that.
And it probably didn't occur to you that you were all that different, or that at some point your government would decide that because of who you were potential trouble.
I don't think so. No way.
You were trouble for other reasons, I'm sure, which
yeah.
We'll get into that later. But I ask every single veteran that I interview about December 7th, 1941, and I've heard some great stories, but I don't think I've ever talked to anybody who was playing a high school basketball game in Lindsay that day. You were down there, the Vikings versus the Cardinals?
I'll take that correction. I was playing with the Japanese American basketball, you might say, club team that we have.
Oh, okay.
It belonged in Parlor, which they call Young Men's Club.
Mm-hmm.
And all of us had different teams in that area. And that particular day, we were down in Lindsay playing a game. And that's where we picked up the story that Pearl Harbor, and we came back to Parlor, and we were just shocked. We all gathered around and talked about it, and then, of course, we all went our way and went home. But that's where it was kind of a shock when we really heard about it.
Did you sense things starting to change after that day in terms of Kingsburg and the surrounding area?
I think it started to show. It started to show. You had the feeling, and you could just have the feeling. I mean, just something's, you know, the feeling of other people. Maybe they thought maybe we had something to do with it. I don't know, but it's just, you can feel it. I felt it.
And you still had relatives in Japan, I'm sure.
Yes, I did. I did. But now I wouldn't know who they were or anything,
right?
Because, you know, it's mostly my dad's side of it, my mom's side of it. But I wouldn't know. I had no contact as far as I'm concerned with.
And you hadn't finished high school yet.
No.
But along in February the next year, along comes Executive Order 9066, and President Roosevelt declares that you, somebody who was born here in the United States, that you're an enemy alien and that you have to go to a relocation camp. I can't imagine what that must have felt like. And how did you deal with that?
Well, you know, at senior at high school, you know, it was the law that you had to register for the draft. And I just turned 18. And, of course, that's what I did. So within a week or so, it got a notice from the local board 124 in Fresno. It classified me as 1A, which was eligible for draft,
mm-hmm.
which is fine with me. That was what we had to do. But when they took us out and sent me to Arizona, to the camp, well, then it was just a week or so after, then I got a notification saying I was reclassified. I opened it up and says I was 4C. Well, that 4C is enemy alien. You know, that's hard to believe that I became an enemy alien. And I talked to my dad. And my dad had one thing over me. He's an alien, but he had a green card, and I was a alien without anything. So it was kind of dad kind of laughed. We kind of chuckled about it. He told me, he says, well, you're an alien. He says, I got a green card. And he says, well, I know you got one up on me there.
Well, and you can laugh about it now, but
yeah.
At the time, I mean, here you are volunteering to go to war for a country who says, oh, we don't want you.
That's right.
You're an enemy alien. Why don't you go over there, give up everything you have, and stay there for who knows how long.
Right.
How big of a hardship was that for your family? What did you lose in the process of being relocated?
Well, I think we were very fortunate. Our dad and mom were there, and they were able to lease the place, which didn't give us much time to lease it, but they were able to lease it on their terms, not on our terms.
Mm.
And so I think the biggest loss there, I'm not saying anything, but it's the person that leased it that took advantage of, if Dad had 42 tons of raisins when they leased it and come back with only 19 tons, and all the 3 years that they had it, it's just 19 tons. You know, something's going on.
Mm-hmm.
So when Dad and my brother came back, then they start making raisins, they got up to 42 tons, which was what's normal.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you just put two and two together, not accusing anybody, but it just didn't add up, you know. But I did approach the person, and he didn't say anything. He just walked away. But after that, every time I saw him downtown Reedley, he'd go across the street and wouldn't meet me face to face because I confronted him with it.
Well, and many other families.
I believe, yes, that's true.
Had it much worse.
Yes.
And never were able to get their land back.
Correct.
Or their crops back.
And probably some of them lost everything.
Mm-hmm.
There are cases, I know, there are cases like that.
So where was the camp that you were sent to?
Gila, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
It's Camp 1. There's two camps there. Camp 1 is Canal Camp.
Mm-hmm.
Number 2 is Butte Camp. And Canal Camp had approximately 6,000. And Butte Camp had about 10,000 plus, more or less. Not really exact figures, but.
Did you ever catch any of the baseball games there?
No.
Because that's some great local legend.
Yes.
About the baseball,
yes,
games put together by Kenichi Zenimura.
Correct.
At Gila River, and some of the great young ball players that came through there went on to play in the Japanese professional leagues, guys like Fibber Hirayama. You were more of a basketball guy, I guess, anyway, huh?
Well, basketball and probably other things too, you know.
I did say the word trouble earlier.
But I did take sumo, you know.
Really?
Yes. I competed in there. We had a fellow from Japan there. You know, he came from Japan, mm-hmm. and he was a big fellow, big fellow. You know, sumo is big guys, you know.
Yeah, I'm trying to match you with sumo, and it doesn't add up in my brain.
I weighed about 175, something like that at that time.
Uh-huh.
And this fellow from Fresno, he was pretty active. He was a judo man.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Oh, come on out. Let's go out for that." And nah, I says, "I don't want to go." So he insisted I go out. So I took him up on it, and I went out. And I kind of participated on that. And by golly, I ended up with a medal. And I thought, wow. But I think most funny part of that is if you ever notice a sumo, what they wear,
mm-hmm.
that is what really fumbled me around, because I didn't want to go up in the crowd and just have that piece of canvas around me, somebody ripping that off of me.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you'd be surprised. I can tug, you can tug and tug and tug, and that'll never come off. And that was my only worry, about somebody ripping that thing off, and I'd be stark naked out there. But that's true. It never comes off. Yeah.
I never would have guessed a sumo wrestler in the past. Our guest today, Robert Yano of Kingsburg, California, 87 years old, and an Army veteran of World War II. And you brought something with you today that originated from your time there at the Gila River internment camp. It's got all kinds of little red dots on it. It looks like some faded fabric. What's it called, and what's the story behind it?
The story is, this is what you call in Japanese a sending buddy. Sending buddy means thousand. 1,000 dots on here. Each dot is put by a lady.
Uh-huh.
And if you wear this around your waist, never take it off, that you'll survive the war and come back.
Mm-hmm.
So while I was in Gila camp, before I was going overseas, a lady came up to me and says, "I want you to have this. I want you to wear it. Take it. So I know that your mom isn't here." So I had all these ladies put these dots on for me. I don't know if you knew anything about it, but I heard about it before through Japanese culture.
Sure.
That this is what they wore, the soldiers wore, before they went to the war. They wore it around their waist, never take it off. And I did. And I took it, and I wore it around my waist. And it's unbelievable, but it was around my waist. You couldn't tell whether it was white, blue, black, or what. But when I got out, after I brought it home, at that time after I got married, I showed my wife, and she says, "What's that?" So I had to explain. She knew what it was about. But she says, "Well, can't wash it, because if you wash it with real hard soap, it'll take out the dot." So I says, "Okay." She says, "You just wash clear, cold water, and this is what remained. It's still intact as far as the dots are concerned."
That's impressive. I've never seen one of those before. And what does it mean to you now when you see it, when you haven't seen it for a while and you have your eyes happen to catch it? What does it remind you of? What does it make you think of?
Well, it reminds me of camp. The most regret I have now, and after all that, is not remembering that lady that gave it to me.
Mm.
And I know she meant it from the bottom of her heart, because I'm sure she had kids of her own too, but she brought it to me thinking that, well, this would bring me home. She went around the whole camp. You can take 1,000 dots. That's a lot of women to put, each one put a dot.
Mm-hmm.
Although there was 6,000 people in it, but that still takes a lot of people to go around and get this dot. And so I really regret not asking her name. She never, maybe she did name herself. I don't know. I can't remember. So many years have passed. But I regret not getting her name and remembering her name.
But obviously, it's still very special to you.
It is. It is. I still take it with me wherever I go and show people this is what it is. And I take it to all the schools. And they're probably in the high school, they're kind of awe, because they just can't believe it. Something like this, you know, has gone, you know, on. You know.
Mm-hmm. That was with you in the Vosges Mountains and everywhere you were with the 442nd.
All the way. All the way over and all the way back. Up in the mountains, down the mountains, wherever. Yeah.
And we'll put a picture of that online at kmjnow.com so you at home can see what he's talking about. But so far, you're still in the camp. How did you end up in the military? After you're classified 1A, they change it to 4C. You're stuck there in the camp. How'd you get out?
Well, they opened up and then start opening the draft and whatnot. And this is where I signed up and decided, well, this is, this is my part to go, because I was expecting that anyway, you know. And I felt that this is something that I have to do.
Even though you knew that other members of your family would still be stuck there in the camp, you're going to go fight for a government that's doing that to your family.
Yeah, it didn't bother me. I just felt that this is part of it. Probably this will show that, you know, that we are loyal Americans. And one thing I could say, my dad never said anything. He just said that you do what you're supposed to do. You were born here. You do what you're supposed to do. Mm-hmm. And that's it.
Did you understand that you'd be serving in a segregated unit?
Yes. Yes, I knew that.
Was that a good thing, do you think? I mean, did that help to know that the guys around you were in the same boat as you?
Well, I mean, never even gave it a thought about that. I just figured that I was going to be in the U.S. Army, and that's it. I mean, I didn't think about segregated unit or whoever was going to be involved in it. I just figured I was going to serve. That's it.
What was your welcome to the Army moment?
Well, at first, after I did get in there, then I thought about, wow, is this the Army, you know? Somebody telling you what to do, you gotta go to sleep, get up, and do this, that. And so it was a little trying to fit into it, but I accepted.
And did they put you in the 442nd Regimental Combat Team right off the bat?
Or? Right off the bat.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, right off the bat. And although when I got there, then they tried to interview me and try to get me into the military intelligence school.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want to do that because I had a brother in the military intelligence school. And he said that, you know, when you come here, you have to study. He says, you got to study real hard. And you have to even go to the restroom. When you're in the restroom, you have to study. And I says, no. I says, I thought to myself, so that's not for me. I says, I don't want to go in there and be studying. I says, I just come here to do other things, not to study. So I told the captain, I says, no, I don't understand Japanese. He says, no. He says, he took a manila folder out, and he says, according to our records, it shows that you did go to Japanese school in such and such a town, Parlier, and you went up to sixth grade. And what could I say? He had the information right in front of me. He's telling me. But I told him, sir, I says, I don't want to go. And that was it. There was no more questions asked.
That gets your attention a little bit when you find out they know more about you than you know about yourself, huh?
Yes, our government knows everything about you.
It was true then, and it's probably true now. And we've heard on this show from veterans from the 442nd, the Gopher Broke Unit, and the Gopher Broke National Education Center down in Southern California does such a terrific job of preserving that legacy. They've interviewed you in the past. People can watch your video online if they sign up there on the website. But I'm sure at that point you hadn't heard this Gopher Broke thing, had you?
No. It was completely new to me.
Yeah. What were you thinking when you joined this unit? What were your expectations of the kind of things that you might end up doing?
I just figured I was going to be just carrying a gun and, you know, going out there. That's it. I mean, I didn't expect too much of anything in particular.
And they didn't give you just a regular gun. They gave you a Browning automatic rifle, the old BAR.
That's what I trained on a rifle. I trained on a motor. I trained on all these other things.
Mm-hmm.
But once the strange part of it, when I first was overseas, when I left, they gave me a Mackinac, which is like Jeep drivers driving. You know, they gave me that. And all the, well, there was, I would say, a handful of us got that. And the others, they all got the regular thing that you want to go and, you know, you do in the Army. And we got these just like Jeep drivers gotten. So we thought ourselves, oh, we're going to be Jeep drivers. But that wasn't so. Once we got over, they took that away and gave us the normal things that everybody else got. So we became riflemen. That's what we became.
Mm-hmm.
Infantrymen.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, we're going to get stories about Robert Yano's time as an infantryman with the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, the Gopher Broke Unit, part of the group of Nisei veterans honored last week in Washington, D.C., along with the MIS, the Military Intelligence Service, and the veterans of the 100th Infantry Division. He'll talk more about that ceremony before we're done as well. And an old friend from his World War II days who we got to see last week in Washington, it's a name that you might be familiar with. We'll come right back with more Hometown Heroes here on News Talk 580 KMJ.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We continue now with 87-year-old Robert Yano of Kingsburg, California, a veteran of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team in World War II. Those were Japanese-American soldiers fighting for our country while their families were still being held in the internment camps around the country. His family was at Gila River in Arizona while he was serving with the 442nd, his brother serving with the Military Intelligence Services. All the Nisei veterans who served in those units were honored last week, whether they were alive or posthumously. They were honored with the Congressional Gold Medal, a terrific ceremony in Washington, D.C. that we're going to talk about a little bit later on. But let's get back to World War II now. Here you are, and you're what, 19 years old?
Yes, 19 years old.
19 years old.
19 years old.
Your mother and father are stuck in a camp.
My dad was.
Your dad was. Your mother was in Japan?
My mother went back in July of 41.
Mm-hmm.
The two sisters, Auntie and my mom, went back for a visit. And so they were there, and then they were returning back to the United States. The boat came back to Seattle Way. Halfway, they turned around and went back.
Mm.
And so from the story that we received later on is that my mother got sick, and she had an operation. And they thought it was appendix. It wasn't appendix. It was, I don't know what you'd call it in English, but your intestines, they twist and they do something. Anyway, she passed away there. So.
But you didn't know this at the time.
I didn't know at the time. I was overseas then, and none of us knew. It was probably a year or two later, through the Red Cross, my dad and my brother got the information that she had passed away there. That was the only communication we had. So after the war was over, then I decided that Mom was still there. I didn't know that she was gone. So I says, well, I'll hook up again and maybe I can go to the Pacific and go to chance and go to Japan. Well, in the meantime, my dad and my brother says, well, you come on home. They didn't want to tell me. They says, you come on home first before you go. And so this is what I did. And when I got home, they says, no, there's no use going. Mom has passed away. And then they explained to me how she passed away and everything. But that was pretty hard.
Wow. That makes it even more unimaginable for me to put myself in your shoes, knowing that your dad is in a camp. You don't even know where your mom is.
Yeah, correct.
Maybe in a country that your own country is bombing.
Correct.
But here you are out there fighting with all these other Japanese-American in a unit that say whatever you want about it. Every superlative you can attach to the 442nd has been attached. The Gopher Broke unit, the most decorated unit of World War II. So many casualties. And you're one of the fortunate ones. You were never wounded during the war.
No, I didn't.
You must be pretty shifty. You must be able to
avoid. Well, I'll tell you, I had a big log over my hole every time I dug in.
Well, tell me about some of that. What was your first taste of combat and the first time that you realized, wow, this is no game, this is no play, this is life or death?
I think, you know, the most important thing, I think, is that, you know, you see or the shells, you hear the guns. You know, at first, as a rookie, you might say, you really don't understand these sounds. But if you stand around some of the veterans, they'll tell you, hey, you listen to this. You hear that? I says, yeah, I hear that. You hear this? Yeah, I hear that. They will tell you. Then you get to know what it sounds when it's a gun is going off or a motor is being dropped. You can hear that pop, and then you can hear bang. As long as you hear that pop, you're not going to get hit. These are some of the ones that go before me will tell you, and I always have high praise for some of the older ones that have experience before you to explain what's going to happen. So, you know, you kind of prepare for things like that. But as a rookie, you learn a lot of things. Dig deeper, dig deeper.
Sometimes that ground's pretty cold and hard to dig in, though.
That's right. That's right. But you try to protect yourself because these are some of the things that the other veterans tell you how to do it.
So you're 19 years old. Talked about your family situation and to me, you'd have to feel like you were so isolated out there, and you don't know if the next day is going to be your last because the Germans are shooting at you every day. What do you think it was that kept you sane and kept you motivated and kept you believing that you could actually get through this?
Well, I think me, probably thinking about my mom.
Just wanting to see her again. Yeah. And even though you never did get to see her again.
I didn't get to see her.
The thought of that helped get you through.
Right.
And about this time, as you're meeting all these other Japanese Americans from all over the country, many of them from Hawaii, you meet up with one young man who you could tell right then had some leadership qualities about him. Who was that guy, and what struck you as being so special about him?
That's Ranking Senator Inouye, Daniel Inouye from Hawaii. Mm-hmm. When I first joined, he was a platoon leader, which is a sergeant at that time. Then he became a battlefield commissioner, second lieutenant. And I think when I joined him at that time, he was a second lieutenant. Mm-hmm. And something about him, to me, it's just the magnetic power. When he says do something or gives you a command, you just follow. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just like I have faith in him. So mm-hmm. I think he's that kind of a man. And if you look at history now, he is a ranking senator in Congress, right?
Yeah,
now.
In the entire Congress. Exactly.
Right, right. So, you know, I think when I look back at that, I think it does hold some truth that he is something.
Well, and he's a guy that I think, too, and in our audience, we have Republicans, we have Democrats, we have independents, but he's a guy, whether you agree with his politics or not, how can you not respect him when you hear about what he went through in the war and you see the decorations that he wears around his neck and on his chest? And
I believe that. He just look at his record, and it speaks for itself. I mean, you know, I've always felt him. When I met him, I felt that he just had something, just something to follow.
And you were there the day he was wounded?
Yes. He was up in the front. He was a little ahead of me, but he was the platoon leader, and the platoon leader was out there giving command, and he gives it to your squad leaders. Mm-hmm. Always the squad leaders come up and they give you directions, and we have to follow with the squad leader, but the command comes from him.
And fortunately, he survived, but there are other times where you saw friends of yours, guys that you had gotten to know very well, guys that even grew up near you here in the San Joaquin Valley, who didn't make it through that day. What did that do to you? How did you deal with that reality of guys to your left and your right dying and knowing that that could be you at any time?
It's something to think about, you know. Maybe just faith in something. And being a Buddhist, I'm a Buddhist, but, you know, in the service, Buddhist, we didn't have no chaplains. We had no chaplains. So it was Christian chaplain, whatever. Mm-hmm. But to me, it just didn't make any difference. I think it's just there's somebody right above you, and you might pray to God, you might say, you know, you want to survive, you want to live. And I think that has more to do with anything.
Sure. And I'm sure that's something that you were able to talk to your fellow soldiers about, or maybe share some encouragement with each other to get through.
We talked about it. We talked about it. You know? Yeah, we all talk. But, you know, get together, we huddle up together and talk about, you know, we want to survive, you know. Maybe we had all different faith. I don't know.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Well, as we talk about guys getting injured and killed around you, and it's well documented, the extreme casualties suffered by your unit, the 442nd in World War II, what would you say was your closest call, the time where you thought for sure this was going to be it for you?
Well, I think this was for one of my squad men right behind me. He was dug in, and he got hit, and it was just, well, he just got hit and he's blown apart. I mean, you couldn't find anything. So they had to pick him up by pieces in a, I say, a pillowcase, but probably, which is something like a pillowcase, by piece by piece. And that, I think, is, and another fellow right behind me, dug in. He got hit behind, but he didn't. He survived, but he got a shrapnel, real serious shrapnel wound. And I don't know how bad it was because I never knew after that. I never saw him, but I don't think it took his life, but those are the things that when you're sitting in the hole and hoping that I don't hope that it doesn't happen to me, you just pray that it doesn't happen to you. You're sitting there. But, you know, when shells are popping all around you, I think it's really makes you something to think about and pray that it doesn't happen. That's it.
For sure. And somewhere in there, you've got your own BAR that you're supposed to get some rounds off in as well. How often did you actually get to fire that thing, and how often did you know what you were shooting at?
Well, when you're shooting at it, sometimes it's a distance. But when you're out with a BR, you can't stay too long in one position. You mm-hmm. have to be moving because, as you know, in the BR, that has a tracer bullet that's in it, and they can tell you where you're shooting from.
Sure.
So you have to change positions. So our squad leaders are very, very smart on that. They tell you where to go. In a squad, there's always this main sergeant tells you what to do. He's the one to guide you.
Did that BAR always work properly for you?
You have to make sure it works properly. By all means, it did work properly because you have to keep it clean. That gun, mm-hmm. you have to keep it clean. It's a heavy gun. I think you can see that. You have 10 magazines that you carry around your waist, 10 magazines plus two bandoliers around your shoulder. And the assistant carries 10 bandoliers for you. So you can about imagine how much firepower that gun has. It has a lot of firepower.
What would you say was the worst, the most severe weather conditions that you had to deal with?
Probably in the wintertime. It can be any place in that area where you have snow, where the snow gets into your foxhole. It gets real, real cold. But, you know, the funny part of this is that, you know, I can't remember one time that I got a death of cold. You shiver, you get through everything. But I don't know. You sometimes pray that, gee, I wish I could get pneumonia so I would get out of here. But it doesn't turn out that way. So I always thought to myself later in life, I always thought that maybe they have something in our ration that they put in there that so we don't catch colds. I always talk about that. You know, as veterans, we talk about it. They put something in those things, I think. That's what we always used to talk about. We joke about it anyway.
Did it seem like it was never going to end?
Don't look at that as never going to end. But I figured one of these days it'd have to come to an end. But mm-hmm. I think as we went along, we could see that we were having more victories, you might say, to our side, plus side, to our side, the American side. Mm-hmm. So I thought maybe eventually it would wind down.
Well, you know, a few years after the war, the movie Gopher Broke was made. And since then, so many books have been written. As I mentioned, there's the Gopher Broke Center down in Southern California that has a memorial and goes out all over the world recording oral histories, including yours. So a lot of people know about this now. But at the time, did you have any idea of how well and how courageous and at how big of a cost your unit was operating? Did you guys have any concept of how unique you were?
I don't think so. I don't think so. I didn't anyway, because mm-hmm. it's just something that you had to do. And I think everybody had the same idea. It's something we had to do.
Of course, kind of the signature event for the 442nd in World War II that gets talked about the most was the rescue of the Lost Battalion, where a couple hundred Caucasian soldiers, for the most part, are rescued by Japanese Americans who end up suffering more casualties than the number of soldiers that they rescued. Did you hear about that at the time?
No, I didn't hear about that. No.
When you did hear about that, did it bother you at all, or did that kind of just add to your esteem for your fellow 442nd veterans?
I think
veterans?
It adds more esteem.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it adds more esteem.
When someone sees you, and you've gone around to schools around the valley to tell your story, you were just in Washington, D.C., and I'm sure you talked to a whole lot of people back there. When someone asks you, 442nd, what was that about? What did you guys do? Why are you special? How do you answer a question like that?
Well, it's really hard to say, you know. In fact, I don't think everybody's ever asked me how it is, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they maybe I might tell them something about it, but they really never come out and say, how do you feel about it, you know? Yeah.
Well, how do you feel about it?
I feel great. I feel we did a good part of it. I mean, I think after all this, you know, that probably changed a lot of thoughts of people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm sure.
What do you think you proved?
Maybe we proved we're good Americans.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I always proved that I'm a good American.
Amen. You know, one of the first Nisei veterans that I had the privilege of interviewing was a guy who actually introduced me to the fig and my love for figs, because he grew them. A guy by the name of Ike Ikeda, or Fumio Ikeda, if you're pronouncing it the correct mm-hmm. Japanese way.
Yeah.
And Ike is gone now, but one of the things that he said, I heard him say so often, that he wanted to prove that his blood was just as red as all the other Americans. You think that happened?
Yeah, I think so. I think he's true on that. Yeah, I think he did a good job on that one, yeah.
When did you get an idea that this time in the military was starting to wind down for you and that war in Europe might be over?
Well, I think in Italy, that's where it felt it's winding down in Italy. That's you can see that at toward the end there. Yeah.
And what did that mean to you? Did that cause some excitement among you?
Well, to me, it did in a way at the end, but I still had that thought about my mom.
Mm-hmm.
That still it was in my head. I was thinking about my mom.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Were there any times where, when you guys came up through the lines, that you were treated any differently because you were Japanese Americans by the other troops?
I don't think so. I didn't feel it anyway. I don't think so. Maybe they had respect for us too.
Well, they better have. They certainly do now, and that congressional gold medal is proof.
I think so, anyway.
Well, we're going to take one more break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the end of the war, coming back home, realizing that his mother had passed away, and more importantly, what he's been doing since then, like that recent trip to Washington, D.C. We'll revisit that part of Bob Yano's story when we come back. It's Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.
This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We come down the home stretch today with 87-year-old Robert Yano of Kingsburg, California, veteran of the 442nd Regimental Combat Team, one of many Nisei veterans from around the country who were honored last week in Washington, D.C. with the Congressional Gold Medal. We're going to talk about that trip before we're done here. But we're going to wrap up his time in World War II first. And if he hadn't made it home from World War II, he never would have met his wife. His two children would have never been born. His five grandchildren would have never been born. Fresno State would have been out a couple pretty good women's golfers. And one of his granddaughters played golf and lacrosse at Fresno State. So the Bulldogs are thankful you made it home from World War II. And I want to talk about coming home. But first, I asked you about the significance of the 442nd. But what about the significance of that slogan, go for broke? When you think about go for broke, what does that mean to you? And what did it mean to you then?
It means go all out, all out, all you can do.
And why was that the mentality?
I don't know. Just
because you had nothing to lose?
Go for broke. Don't lose.
Your families are already held captive.
Yeah.
I mean, what else are they going to do to them, right? You got to prove it somehow. And there was something from your Japanese culture, a word in Japanese that you'd heard spoken around the home that kind of became your mantra for the war. What was that?
It's gaman.
And what does that mean?
That means you just have to take it, whether you like it or not. You just take it, gaman. You just.
And it becomes kind of a test of your will and your character, how much you can take.
That's right. You can take a lot. Human body can take a lot.
I bet you didn't plan on taking as much as you did.
No, but it's a necessity, you might say, sometimes.
Now, there are, in war, there are incredibly difficult moments, things that you can't even imagine surviving. And there are also those lighthearted moments that give you a little chuckle. And you experienced one of those small world moments when you were all the way over in Rome, Italy, for 10 days of R&R, and you had a reminder of Kingsburg. Tell me about that.
Yes, I went to we had a 10-day R&R in Rome, and a fellow soldier and I, we went to Red Cross and having coffee and donuts and going ahead and looking at the registration books. And I happened to open up a book, drinking coffee and looking at it, and all of a sudden I noticed this name, Walden Johnson, Kingsburg, California, 34th Division. Well, that kind of stunned me. I opened my eyes. I told my buddy, I says, hey, this guy just lives half a mile down the road from me. Went to the same grammar school and everything. So that was really something. I thought, boy, I've come all this way, and here he is right here at the same place I am at.
How about that? It's a small world. And you'll have another reunion that we'll talk about here in a moment. And he still is somewhat of your neighbor there in Kingsburg?
Yes, he's still living there now. Uh-huh. He's I go visit him every once in a while. I just went and I talked to the wife here a couple of days ago, mm-hmm. asking how Walden is doing. And he says, oh, he's doing okay. And he wanted me to come by and visit and tell him about this Congressional Gold Medal. And I thought, well, in a few days I'll call back and see if he's able to. I like to go back and talk to him because he's always been nice to me. We've always been close.
After the war, you guys yes. have kept in touch ever since, and maybe he's listening right now, so maybe he's hearing some about this. Another thing that sticks out for you, and I guess some would say for you to be in the 442nd and to never be wounded, you beat some pretty good odds. Luck was on your side or destiny or whatever, and I guess that was the case with you winning the draw for a camera from your unit as well.
Yeah, I think at that time they had a lottery system like you give a camera And of course, our company or our platoon was lucky enough to draw this lottery camera that was given out, and I was lucky to get it. And with this camera, I was able to take the Mussolini event that was taking place up there in Lake Como. It was a little bit above Lake Como, but I happened to be in that region area, and I took a picture of this, of him being mutilated, I guess you might say, hung up on piece of, you might say, a board or whatever it was he was hung up. I noticed you'll probably see it in different books or something like that.
Absolutely. Benito Mussolini, the Italian dictator, mm-hmm. had been killed, hung up, and left on display for everyone to see. Obviously, that was for a symbolic value. What did it symbolize to you? Did that make you feel like your job as a soldier and as your unit was almost complete?
No, I don't think so. I still say I had a soft part in my heart that I probably didn't think it was right because, you know, after all, he is a human. And but that is committed by the guerrillas. It's their own people that committed those things. So mm-hmm. it's not our troop that did it. It's their own people that did it.
Well, and we've seen just recently what a people that's been persecuted can do to a leader when he's finally captured. You look at Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, correct. And that's very similar to what happened.
That's correct.
To Mussolini.
That's correct.
When did you find out you were coming home?
Well, it wasn't much after that. I think there was come by the point grades. I don't remember how that system works, but you have to be over so many years or so many months overseas. They have a point system that you accumulate, and the more points you have, the sooner you get to come home.
And at this time, you still don't know what's happened to your mother. You believe that she might be in Japan, and you know there's still a war going on in Japan, so you were kind of wanting to go there. Her family had been in Hiroshima. And so you don't know any better than she's there in Hiroshima. And come August of 1945, you hear about this atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. What was your first thought? What did you think had happened?
Well, I kind of thought maybe she might be gone, but wasn't really sure because if she was living in Hiroshima, she would be gone. But but that was my main thought. I think all the time that I was there, I kept thinking about her. Mm-hmm. Because that is my mom. I think mom is much closer than fathers are, I think, as far as my feeling is. Mm-hmm. I always thought about mom. Mom was always there. So that was the point that I was thinking that after this is over, I said I'd sure like to go over there. I did hook up again, but it just so happened my dad and my brother said, come on home before you go, because they had been notified by the Red Cross that mom had passed away. So they insist I come home, and which I did. I went home, and then they told me, no, there's no use of you going there because mom is gone. So then that closed the picture. But if you look at it, at that time, it was 3 years. So 46 and 49 would be the year that I'd be up. But if you look at it in the years, it wasn't much more. The Korean War came up. So I think that if it was, I'd probably been in the Korean War too, but it just luckily that I was out before the Korean War came up. So
you would have reenlisted, but your father and brother saved you from what you would have experienced.
I think that's the truth because they told me to come home.
And I know you shared it earlier, but I want to hear it from your mouth. I think I put the words in your mouth earlier. In terms of your mother, obviously there was a lot of grief when you found out that she was gone. Do you feel like it was her, the thought of a potential reunion with her, that helped you get through everything you faced?
I think so. I think so, because you have that hope that you want to be back so you can meet. I did. I want to be home so I could be my mom again, definitely.
What was it like to get back home and to see your brother and your father again?
It's a big, big relief, I tell you. It's something that, you know, you kind of look forward to. But actually happening, I think everybody will realize it. I mean, when you go through something and want to be home, it just makes you big relief, big relief.
And you shared with us earlier that your family was able to get back the property and to resume growing raisins and all of that. Other families were not. But at the time, was there any anger on your part or your family about the fact that they had been interned, that so many families like yours had that done to them?
I don't think in our family we even talked about that. Mm-hmm. We just talked about coming back, and I know my dad and my brother, the first thing they came back was, actually they came back to the old home that we had. It was all, you might say, it wasn't, you know, it was a big home, but it wasn't the best when we left, but still it was home. And when they came back, they thought that They were just couldn't live in it no more because somebody had just torn it all apart. Mm. And it was nothing, you couldn't live in it. It wasn't livable anymore. So what they had done, they at the time, they had what they call Office of Price Administration. I believe it was the federal program that you had to get a permit to get lumber, nails, whatever, to build the house or whatever. And they sent an application, and that was turned down. Because you got to figure that was right after the war, and probably everything was still short supply.
Sure.
But what they did do after that, they tore down the barn, they tore down the shed, they tore down their whole house. My dad and my brother, and one more man from down south that lived and helped my dad and them, and they tore everything down, and they took all the lumber, and they built the garage to live in, made it a future home, but it turned out to be a home, but it was a garage that they built. They stuck with it because it's all old lumber, and they made livable condition rooms, kitchen, whatnot. That's what they lived in.
It's another Gaman situation.
Yeah, that's just a square room. That's all it was.
Well, and I guess if that is your mantra, that Japanese expression Gaman, to bear it, then you're not going to complain about anything, huh?
No, they just went right ahead and did it. That's it.
And what about you? How did you get back into the swing of things, and how did you look forward after everything you'd been through that would cause so many guys to kind of dwell on their experiences?
No, I came back. Of course, you know, I was still quite young yet. And, of course, you know, in Japanese, you have oldest son always looks after the parents. That's the old tradition. Of course, my oldest brother, he was there. And as came back, I told my brother, I said, okay, you're the oldest. You can stay with Dad, take care of Dad, take care of the farm and everything. He says, I'll just pack up and go on someplace. I says, I don't have to be here. I says, I can probably go to school on GI Bill or whatever it is. I says, I've got some other plans if I don't farm. But he insisted that I farm. He didn't want to farm. But I found later because he wanted to get married and his wife didn't want to look after my dad. And so you know how that goes. I think everybody goes through that situation.
Sure.
So anyway, he insists I stay, so I stayed. So I told him, before you go, I said, now, understand that now. You have the first right to look after my dad. You have the rights to farm. You have all the rights. So I don't want to say later on that day.
Right.
You know, how come you got it, you know?
Sure.
So anyway, that's what happened. I stayed back, farmed with Dad. We farmed together, put the money together. It always happens, no matter how you look at it, that farm, it create funds for whether my brother does another job or whatever, he goes into business, or my other brother goes to school. It all came back from the Yano farm. Little it may be, but it all came back. So that comes from Dad and Mom. And to this day, it little piece of ground is still theirs, not mine. It's theirs. So that's the way I look at it.
And I'm sure you would like to pass that on to future generations of your family.
Yes, that's the way. And so it's the 40 acres.
Mm-hmm.
So out of the 40 acres, wife and I, we give my son an acre and a half or so. We give our daughter and son-in-law another same amount, tried to give the same amount, so they built their home on. But that ranch is still there. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't die away. It doesn't go away. It's still there. So we figured if we do that, the Yano farm was still there. So that's the way it is today. Balance is probably sold, but my house, my kid's house, my son-in-law's house, and my daughter's house, it's all there.
So that legacy will live on, and clearly the legacy of the 442nd specifically, and in general, Nisei veterans as a whole, has really been preserved by so many different people. And the latest thing to come about, this Congressional Gold Medal, you got to go to Washington, D.C., take your daughter with you.
Yes.
And one of the things you did, in addition to getting that medal, was you saw that guy that you knew way back when, Daniel Inouye, the senator from Hawaii. What was that reunion like for you?
It was a real, real good reunion. At least, you know, he's a ranking senator. And, you know, just me, just a little ordinary guy out here, you know, that's completely black and white, you might say, if you look at it.
Right.
But he gave me a big smile and says, we took a picture together. I says, Company E, 1st Platoon, 3rd Squad, he had a smile a mile wide. Mm. So he knows what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Give us a taste of what you experienced there in Washington, the whole time you were there, and what the highlights were for you.
You know, I look at that, and I think that Washington, it's military. It's everything is pertaining to military.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care where you look at it, how you look at it, Washington, D.C. is military.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody got a job, looks like.
We're paying for those jobs, too.
Yeah.
What was it like for you to be around all these other Japanese-American veterans of World War II?
Kind of, to me, it brings the old camaraderie back again, the 100 and 442, you know. You look at it, you look at all the guys, you know. Of course, we're all up in age, you know. We're all just wheelchairs, barely moving around, some of them crutches and whatnot. But I think it brings that old feeling back again. I think so.
Was there any moment in the ceremony, anything that was said that was especially meaningful to you?
I think the most I got out of it was listening to John McCain.
Mm-hmm.
He seems to be really sincere, really from the heart, because maybe he was a POW for 5 years, but it just seems like it just took it hard too. So he's one that really.
And I'm guessing that as part of your time there, they took you to the World War II Memorial.
Yes, did. I went through that, walked all the way around that. There's so many things there, but that was very, very important to see for me.
Did you take a moment, and I've been there many times, and each time it's emotional for a lot of different reasons, and you see so many other veterans any time that you're there. When you stand by that fountain and the backdrop is all the gold stars signifying more than 400,000 Americans who died in World War II, and so many of them were in the 442nd, guys that you knew, guys that you knew you grew up by, that you spent time around. When you see those stars now, what does that make you think of?
Kind of makes your blood boil. You read it, you feel it.
Mm.
I do.
And
that's a supreme sacrifice. That's a supreme sacrifice.
You have 5 grandkids. I made reference to a couple of your granddaughters who have been sports stars here in the Valley, basketball and golf, and you've got a granddaughter, Shaylee, on the Bulldog golf team now at Fresno State. But when you think about future generations of your family, when you go around to schools and talk about it, what do you want people to understand about what the 442nd did, what Americans in general did in World War II?
I don't think that too much of what we did, because I don't think that, you know, to them, I don't think the younger generations know, but we do. I do. I mention it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the younger group, they won't get it. They won't understand too much. But I would think that the most important age probably would be 7th and 8th grade or high school level. They seem completely more interested in, you'll find kids asking questions. And mm-hmm. I think that's really important in the high school level.
And what is it you want them to know?
Well, I think it's good for them to know that what all GIs did or sacrificed did. It doesn't matter just to us. It's in general, all, everybody.
Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our audience about your time in the military, your experience of getting the Congressional Gold Medal and all the things that you've gone through?
I have no regrets of all the things that I've gone through. I had some good and I had some bad, but I had a lot of good things. Got to travel, but those are the good side.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a lot of moments that you didn't know whether you're going to come through or not. But I think all said and done, I think it turned out. Maybe somebody was looking after me. I don't know. And unfortunately, some didn't make it, but that's the price. Something has to be paid for.
What would you say that you're most proud of?
Macy's most proud of me being recognized. I think so. As long as we are recognized for our part,
mm-hmm.
as an organization, as an outfit, or whatever you might call it. And so people can really know what we did.
I don't want to go too far, but it almost seems to me, and years ago, you know, obviously the executive order that Roosevelt signed created all of that chaos and really catastrophe for Japanese Americans. Years later, the government apologized, and I don't think that necessarily made it better for everybody. But do you think with this Congressional Gold Medal ceremony that this kind of put some closure to your whole experience and told you, yes, what you did was important, yes, we know you're real Americans, and beyond that, we thank you for what you did. Did it feel kind of like that for you?
I think it did, because that is something. That's something. That's just anybody don't get that. So it is. It's a closure.
And I bet it was special for you to have your daughter with you. She would have never been born if you didn't make it home from the war, and here she is getting to experience all of that with you.
Yeah. It takes both of my kids. Mm-hmm. It takes both of them, because I don't think I would even be able to go without them because of my age and not being able to really step it up like the younger people.
Who do you think was more proud, you or your son and your daughter?
I don't know about that one. Maybe I was more proud. Maybe they were proud, too. I'm sure they were proud of it.
Well, they're not here to speak for themselves at the moment, but I think I can safely say they were pretty proud of their dad last week in Washington, D.C. We've got more information about that Congressional Gold Medal online at kmjnow.com. You can also see photos of what Robert Yano looked like then and what he looks like now. Well, I just want to thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling your story, and keep doing it, all right?
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. That's Robert Yano of Kingsburg, California, and we'll be back next week with another edition of Hometown Heroes on News Talk 580 KMJ.